is the Autism Spectrum Task Force, and Lynn Aves, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair and members, there are significant differences in the membership of the task force. The Senate and the House each have two members from the Senate and the House on their committees. I think probably the biggest difference is that the Senate task force has 11 members and the House task force has 25 members. So there's a greater variety of individuals in the community of the public that are represented on the House committee than there is on the Senate task force. The Senate has two parents of children with autism spectrum disorder. The House has three parents of those children. The House also has two public members who have autism spectrum disorder, a public member representing an agency that provides employment services, a public member representing an agency that provides residential services, a public member who's a behavioral analyst, two public members who are providers of ASD therapy, a director of a public school student support services, two members of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it specifies what their specialties are, a member appointed by the Association of Minnesota Counties, and one member appointed by the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. There are some other differences in how the committees work, if you'd like me to go into that.
Yes, please.
For the election of the chair, the Senate elects their chair at the first meeting, and the House elects a chair from the public members. There's different assistance from the state agencies. The Senate stipulates assistance only if federal or state funding is available, and the House doesn't include that stipulation. It specifies that information must be provided by the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services. In the topics to be examined, the Senate adds recommendations on methods to address geographic discrepancies in the delivery of services. The House does not. The House adds recommendations on ways to enhance Minnesota's role in autism spectrum disorder research and delivery of services. The Senate does not. The House also adds recommendations on methods to educate parents, family members, and the public, and to educate them about available services. The Senate does not. And then there are other minor technical differences between the two.
Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Chairman, as I understand, your language was a floor amendment. I just wanted to let you know that this bill, as it was going through the process, did receive a fiscal note. And in the Senate version, that fiscal note has been removed.
It's Article 8.
Senator Berglund, the House is willing to accept the Senate position on this. I don't know if you want to do that now or...
That would be fine with me. I would move the Senate position be adopted in regard to the Autism Task Force.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so we have the Senate language on the Autism Task Force.
Mr. Chair, what article and page was that, do you know?
For the Ms. Aves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it is in Article 8, and it's House just Section 29,
okay.
Section 87.
They're just trying to find where it is. Did you find it?
I did. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, let's go on. We're going to hold off on the dental carve-out. And Representative Thiessen on item number 3 on this short list here.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Do we
have
a copy of the short list?
Yes.
No, that's a long list.
Mr. Chair, in the House, we passed language. I think in both bills, there's language that with the ratable reductions, that they would also go into the PMAP program, and so they'd be reduced 3% or what have you. And in the House, we put language in the bill that would say that those rate reductions that the plans basically can't pass on those rate reductions to the providers. And it comes somewhat, I think, back to the issue we were talking about the other day about the reserves and the amount of money that the plans are making on our public programs. But I do have some Mr. Rivness who would like to talk about it.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Chair, before we get started, can we tell me where the language is, just so I can be tracking a little better, if you would, please.
It's in Article 6, and anywhere there's a rate reduction, we have language. It's in several places, but maybe we can just identify one particular provision.
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
And I don't have my book with me.
Mr. Chair, I think I found once. Article 6, House, Section 40.
That's right where we were with the birthing centers. I'm open right to it.
Article 6?
Yeah. Birthing centers are in the other side.
Oh, okay. Oh, the rates.
R 69.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's that last sentence.
You ready?
Mr. Rivness.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Phil Rivness, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association. Some years ago, when we started writing our legislators indicating that medical assistance and Minnesota Care, GAMC, had not been increased in terms of the fee schedule for many, many years, and as of today, I think it's 19 years for fee-for-service MA. Except 1 year in 1999, there was a 3% increase. So that was many, many, many years. But a few legislators responded to us by saying, well, but you have gotten small increases in PMAP. And we couldn't find anybody who'd ever gotten an increase in PMAP in the last 10 years. And so we started inquiring with the Department of Health, their economics unit, with the Department of Human Services to find out what those increases were to the health plans, and I finally managed to get a sheet, and if I do have some copies of the increases annually that the Department of Human Services had negotiated with health plans. We know that some of these increases were because of more covered lives, those kinds of things, but what was clear to us is that none of these increases were going to providers. So medical assistance, for instance, from 1999 to 2007 went up 46%. GAMC went up 154%, and Minnesota Care 128%, the prepaid portion of it. But none of that went to providers. And so one of the thoughts we had in this session and in the budget process is we would encourage you to look to the people who've had increases, not for this cut, and not to the people who have not had any increases since 1999. And we think that would be much more fair for you to consider. And I think the legislative auditor indicated that the department, in negotiating annual increases, was not even communicating with plans regarding increases for providers in those budgets. So we think that this would be a good year to indicate that if you need, for budget balancing purposes, some money to come from PMAP, that it would be good that it not be passed on to providers in this instance.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I mean, one of the and we've been trying to understand and had several meetings or a couple of meetings, I guess, during the course of the session around this issue of how do we negotiate these PMAP contracts, what goes into it, and it was one of the takeaways that's clear from those discussions is that there have been no rate increases passed on to providers, even though we're increasing what we pay to the plans, because it's really about case mix and that's largely what, you know, I guess accounts for the increase and utilization that accounts for the increase in provider into the PMAP rates. I'd also note that we just had a long debate on the House floor about a bill that Representative Gottwald's brought forth that says basically we're going to put a certain class of Minnesota care people into the private market with private plans. We're going to pay commercial rates to those for, you know, those patients are going to be paid commercial rates, and it's going to cost less, according to the department's fiscal note, than our current Minnesota care program. So the Department of Human Services has come out now with a fiscal note that basically says we can pay commercial rates if we use individual private market plans. We can, and we're going to provide the same amount of coverage, and we're going to save money doing it, which begs the question of where is the money. It's got to either be because the department is estimating that fiscal note wrong, or because, and one of the reasons I think they came up with that note is because there's an estimate that instead of $2,000, which or whatever the rate is for the PMAP plan, most people only use about $500 or $600. And so we're paying much more to the plans for much less utilization. Now, whether that's correct or not, I mean, I'm not sure that that's the case. But it really begs the question of where's the money, where's that money going? If we can pay commercial rates for our public programs and not cost any more money, it's got to be somewhere. And so it kind of begs the same question that Mr. Rivness is raising about where's the money?
Let me ask Representative Thiessen a question. How does this relate to... we have to have actuarially sound payment to health plans?
Well, I don't know if we've gotten exactly the answer. Maybe the department can come up and talk about that. Although, if we're saving money in the commercial market for a better plan paying commercial rates, we're paying way over actuarially sound, it seems to me.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one perspective to that I learned in visiting with Jim Nobles on his recent study, and that is my understanding is the department was not calculating in earnings on the reserves attributable to public payments as a part of those budgets for those years. And I think that's now changed since last year, but I think for many of those years, you could almost reverse it and say we were being way too generous from an actuarial standpoint, because a source of revenue that's very real, and that's earnings on reserves attributable to public programs, was not taken into account. I would stand corrected if I'm not describing that accurately.
Ms. Peed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Karen Peed with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. If I might first to the testifier's question. In looking at rates, and I was questioned by one of the health plans on this. I recently said that we estimate a margin for health plans, or we think a reasonable margin for health plans that are nonprofit in Minnesota to be able to contribute to reserves is between 1% and 3%. And when we go as high as 3%, we are taking into account their interest earnings at that point. We don't offer a margin as high as 3%, at least not intentionally. So although it's not specifically, it had not until this last year been specifically considered in the rate development, that was examined in our rate development. So that's the answer to your question. There are so many moving parts to this question, this conversation. I'm not sure what sequence I should go in. The savings that shows on the fiscal note for Representative Gottwald's bill, House 51865, is attributable to cash flow, because we don't settle up with MSHA until a period of time that's outside what is displayed on the fiscal note. So those numbers approach zero over time.
And Mr. Chair, can I just ask a follow-up on
Representative
that?
Representative
Thiessen. Are there going to be savings in that for 1865 in the fiscal note then, or is it going to cost us money?
Mr. Chairman, the best that we can estimate, we don't have Representative Gottwald and the people who prepared this proposal have made a number of assumptions. We didn't agree with all of the assumptions that they made. Our experience with the Minnesota CARE population of adults without children is that that's a voluntary population. They choose to be enrolled. Most of them come to the program because they have a health care need that needs to be addressed. The rates that we're paying are developed based on costs that plans have incurred serving that population. So the best that I can say is that part of the savings may be attributable to what will happen when individuals, and we have an estimate in the fiscal note of how many people will get through the entire amount of $2,100 that's made available to pay claims, or the promise to pay as it's been described in testimony. We've estimated the number of those people that would get through that amount, and then they would come up on a $1,000 deductible that they have to pay themselves. This is a population that is not wealthy, and $1,000 out-of-pocket expense is significant for them. And so it may just mean that there's some suppression of utilization of healthcare costs, and maybe that's appropriate, maybe it's not. It's you know, a very theoretical discussion at this point.
Mr. Chair, there is
Representative Thiessen.
If they were to use their up to the $10,000, at least on the hospital cap, though, they would be paying $1,000 out of pocket anyway, because there's a 10% copay on that, right, under Minnesota CARE?
Mr. Chairman, Speed. Representative Thiessen, that's correct. However, the difference in the benefit set is that not everybody goes to the hospital, but everybody who gets through the $2,100 would incur that regardless of what service they utilize. So it might be prescriptions outside the limit. It might be just physician visits or other kinds of services that were required.
I think so.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Peed, I realize we're getting off of the subject a little bit here, but just one question that I've had in regard to that proposal is that our benefit set is so different than the AMSHA benefit set that it would seem to me that if this were going to happen, that there would be additional administrative costs to AMSHA, and they would want to charge those back to the program.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that is not within the scope of the fiscal note that we prepared. The intent was that eligible people would receive the same benefits under AMCHA that would be made available in the package that was described, and so there may be some differences.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that a little bit, you know, the lowest deductible AMCHA has is $500, and then it's an 80-20 after you meet your 500. I mean, that's so different than Minnesota CARE. It would just seem to me inevitably they would have to, for a small group of people, be setting up a whole different administrative structure to administer the benefits and claims.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, as I say, it's sort of outside my scope. I'm not able to speak on their behalf, and I don't know if there's anyone from AMCHA who...
Well, do you know if that was figured into the fiscal note?
Mr.
Or whatever
Chairman,
somebody's talking about in terms of a fiscal note? I haven't actually seen an official fiscal note on it.
Mr. Chairman, we did not figure in AMCHA administrative costs. We did look at that the department would need to make AMCHA whole, and that there would be costs on an ongoing basis that we would need to settle up at the end of every year, where whatever was required for our enrollees, if you will, that wasn't contemplated in the ordinary AMCHA benefit set.
Representative Thiessen.
To kind of bring it back to the maybe more close to the subject that we're talking about,
yep,
kind of notwithstanding whether, you know, it's $20 million over or $20 million under what we're currently paying for this population, the fact remains that the providers would be getting paid commercial rates, which I would imagine must amount to several tens of millions of dollars for this population, the differential. Maybe I'm wrong about that. That money has to be coming from somewhere, right? And so where's that money?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, I don't know. The only thing that I can assume is that there will be differences in utilization. I don't have another answer for that.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and we're kind of putting you on a weird spot here. I understand that, but the bottom line is that either the fiscal note is off, and more people either will be going into MSHA, so it's more expensive, or the amount of money that is going to pay for each, you know, which they're estimating about $589 a person, I think, for each enrollee instead of 2,000 will be spent on health care. So either some of those assumptions are wrong, and the fiscal note is actually going to cost a lot more, or we're overpaying for our PMAP program. And I think those are the only two options that I can come up with. And so, you know, I guess I'll just leave it with that.
Well, let me ask Ms. Speed a question. It seems to me the Department of Health, which you're not in, and the legislative auditor have looked at the administrative overhead of the various health plans in their state programs as well as their commercial programs, and have about an 8% on the average administrative cost. Is there any dispute over those numbers? I mean, we're paying them so much per patient or per enrollee, and they take out 8% to do what they need to do, and the rest of the money has to go to providers, it seems to me.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any dispute over those numbers.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I don't claim to know how the health plans decide to pay their providers. But I do know one thing, back to the conversation we had earlier this morning. The fee-for-service hospital rate for normal delivery is $900. So we certainly know that the PMAP plans are not paying $900. Otherwise, $1,600 would be looking damn good to everybody. So, you know, they're paying more than what they started out with in the base of the actuarial programming, because all of the revenues that the plans got when we started out were based on our fee-for-service rates, and they've grown since then, and apparently, at least in this area, the payments have grown also.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Solon.
To Senator Berglund's point, I've actually heard from members in my district who say that with the new fee that has been identified for the birthing, that they do get paid more. They would get paid more under that than they would under the medical assistance.
Well, if they're, Mr. Chairman and Senator Prittner Solon, if they have quite a few fee-for-service births, they would be, yeah.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. And just on the MSHA thing, they kept selling us, I've heard it 100 times, they make MSHA whole. I'm not sure what that means. But if you want to know more detail, I'm sure Representative Gottwalt and one of his colleagues could come and offer the committee some information. But I have a question for Ms. Pede. But it is interesting. Representative Thiessen's question is my question, too. How can you, what in effect the Gottwalt proposal says, and you're department seems to agree conceptually, we can raise provider rates 50% and do it for minus 10, 0, or just some nominal amount of money difference. And that's the phenomenon that we're all interested in. Ms. Pede, when you contract or negotiate this actuarially sound rates, how much do you know, about the companies you're giving the rates to when you agree to pay them a rate? Do they disclose to you what they pay to a provider, what their last year's rate was, what the trend is, a lot of detailed information, or do you have to go based upon fee-for-service utilizations and kind of impute a bunch of stuff?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, we gather information every year. It is not on a rate-by-rate basis or a provider-by-provider basis. It is in, for lack of a better word, I would say large buckets. So what was spent on hospital costs, inpatient and outpatient physician costs. So we would have the data aggregated up. So we know what their spending was. We don't have it on a rate-by-rate or procedure-by-procedure basis or a provider-by-provider to the extent that there may be differences in provider payment from region to region, for example.
So Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy has a bill about the, what we think of as the black box. And is that information that you get privileged, or is that information that's available to people who want to know it?
Ms. Pede.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the legislature just gave authority to DHS to collect that information and to make that information non-public so that we weren't compromising the whatever competitive arrangements or different contracting arrangements the health plans may have out in the community. We were targeted to begin to collect that information in 2010. There are some refinements in the bill that Representative Murphy has proposed and that I believe has been considered in both houses.
But Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Ms. Pede, you made an agreement last year about what to pay plans based upon, I'm not talking about the future information, I remember the health reform and all that stuff we'll be collecting. But what do you know specific information that Medicare pays an amount and Health Partners pays so much out, and can you track by health plan how much they're expending on providers?
Mr. Chairman, as I said earlier, we do collect that information. It's at an aggregate level. We have not collected it. For instance, what is the payment for a particular procedure with a particular provider? We get that information in larger aggregate amounts.
All right, and I don't want to spend all day on this, but it's a question that seems to recur. And so do you have an idea what one plan pays, like, you know how many patients they might have seen? Do you know, like, what's kind of going on? Because we don't know where the money goes either. We're puzzled. We talk about here about reserves and rates, and you hope you don't go above 3%. And we hear admin now is up to 10.9, I think, percent on some of the plans. And you understand the question, and I don't know if I'm putting you in a bad spot to not want to answer a question, but I still remain puzzled.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I believe I understand the question, and what I'm saying is that we know what the plan spent, but apparently not at the level that you're asking. We're authorized to collect the data at a more detailed level beginning in 2010. We intend to do that. We looked at, there's language that tells us how we need to aggregate that up and report it out to the legislature and make that available to the public. So I hope that a year from now, well, let's see, will we be done with it a year from now, a year and a half from now, that we will have filed a report and, you know, that legislators will feel that they've been provided with more information about how the money is spent.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And just kind of to close the loop, three things that I'd offer up. The first is we did have conversations and actually got letters from several of the plans and county-based purchasing units about how they do negotiate and talk about their public programs. And they all do it differently. And this was very high level, but they all kind of take different approaches to how they do it. And so, you know, I guess and how they interrelate public programs and the commercial market. The second thing that I would say is, while I'm thinking that, I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer that's kind of relevant to this, to the House language. It's the A91-1 amendment, and it's a little bit of a, it's kind of, Senator Berglund challenged on kind of the reserves issue, that we come up with a different way of approaching the excess money that may be going to the plans, and basically this would give them a 1% above, they would be able to hold on to 1% above what their costs are and have to return the rest of the money back to the state for the public programs. And so I'd just like to put this on the House language as something that we can discuss as we move forward as an alternative to kind of doing the reserves surplus thing and collecting that money back.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, do you have a fiscal note on this?
Not yet. Well, we have to get the language to get the fiscal note for it.
Well, I can guarantee you that limiting the rate increases over the next biennium to 1% isn't going to equate to what we have in our bill.
Well, maybe so. So I'd like to move to put that in.
So Representative Thiessen moves the 91-1 amendment to the House language in the bill. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, procedurally, what happens? I mean, if we adopt this, it's not adopted in the joint thing. It's just allowing you to amend the House language, what you're bringing forward. Right.
Representative Laurie, I think we've done that three or four times for Senate language already.
Oh, I must have been sleeping. I'm sorry.
So any further discussion of that? All those in favor of the 91-1 amendment to the House language signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
And then the last thing I'd like to offer, Mr. Chair, is back to those letters. In at least one of the letters from the plans, and maybe more than one, there was a reference to the fact that when we have cut rates in the past, the plan said in their letter, we haven't passed on those rate reductions to the providers. And all the language, which is what we started with in this whole discussion, the language that we're put that the House has put into the bill basically does that. And I can get I can get those letters to people to help them out. So to this issue of actuarially soundness, the fact that past practice has, they've said in their letter that when we've reduced rates in the past, those rate reductions haven't been passed on, it seems to me that we're not asking for anything particularly different than that.
Well, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, I think probably the magnitude of what we're talking about here this year is different. And I would think the magnitude could make a difference in whether or not an organization is able to absorb these reductions or whether they have to pass them on.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. I didn't vote in the last amendment. I wasn't sure how to vote, and so I know it's a work in progress, but maybe the plans want to come talk to us about this language and just offer a thought for us.
And the whole subject.
I think, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Coleman. I'm with Medica, and unless somebody in my industry yells out, I'm representing the Council of Health Plans right now, they'll let me know if I go astray, and I no longer am. I just wanted to first comment on the amendment that Representative Thiessen put on to this language here, and just having a quick chance to look at this, it appears that what this is doing is putting a cap on what the margins that a health plan can have in government programs, but what it fails to do is to put any protection on what the losses of a health plan can do. And so Ms. Peed here can certainly comment on aspects of this, but just to briefly understand, there's different types of contracts that health plans can enter into, whether it be with the state or whether it be with the federal government. And, for example, in Medicare, there's what's called risk contracts and there's what's called cost contracts. And a Medicare risk contract is where you're paid a certain amount, but you take on all of the risk. And that, unless Ms. Peed would correct me, that's analogous to what the contract is in Minnesota. The other types of contract that exist are called cost contracts. Some health plans in Minnesota have them with the federal government for pieces of Medicare. And if you set a target, and if the money you bring in, your margin, is higher than some said threshold, you actually give back money to the government. At the same time, if your losses are worse than a certain threshold, the government makes you, not makes you whole, but returns some of that losses. So our concern with this would be it's not a risk corridor, it's not a cost contract, it's just basically saying you can't have more than 1% margin, but you can lose as much money as possible. Now, when you combine that with the fact that in Minnesota, in order to have an HMO license, we are required to participate in government programs, And so that certainly adds some concern on to this as well. Also, if you look at the years where plans have had losses and gains, you know, it averages out to a certain margin. But if you were to say on years where you lose, you know, 2 years ago Medica lost $35 million, well, we would have been stuck with that. But in a year where we maybe made $20 million or $35 million, that kind of balanced that out, you don't get to balance that out. So you're stuck with all the losses, but you're capped at 1% margin. That would be extremely concerning, and I would look to Ms. Pete as to far as from a contractual standpoint, if that would even be legal.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, and I guess the only question I'd ask, that's essentially the same thing that the Senate's proposal on taking the reserves. You'd make the exact same argument in response to that proposal as well, right?
Well,
Ms. Coleman.
Madam and Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, I believe we've testified against that as well.
Right, but this is just kind of, Mr. Chair, this is basically a more direct way of doing what the Senate is proposing they do with the reserves.
Well, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I think there's a major difference here. We aren't taking all of the reserves.
No, this
isn't either. The proposal doesn't affect a number of the health plans are not even affected by it. And we can't go back and retroactively limit what we've given in the past. So, you know, the issue really is what is a level of reserve for a public health plan program that is adequate. I think that's the issue in terms of the Senate position.
And Mr. Chair, just on that point, in terms of the equities of this, my understanding from the Senate's proposal is that a plan, you know, if you're looking plan by plan, a plan that actually lost money in the most recent year is actually going to have to pay out by magnitudes, we're going to take the biggest piece of their reserve. And plans that have actually made money, we're taking a very small, like for Blue Cross, which is kind of done better than some of the other plans, we're taking, I think, $3 million, $6 million. For Medica, which actually lost money in the last year, we'd be taking $18, $19 million or more under the proposal the Senate put on. So I'm not sure if that's the most equitable way to approach this either. This at least treats everybody the same.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, if I just wanted to comment to one other thing that Representative Thiessen said about letters that had been requested from some of the plans to explain increases to providers that did or did not take place. And I think, Representative Thiessen, you did comment that a lot of the increases to the PMAP was due to utilization. I can tell you, I think Medica, our letter, we did share the fact that over the years, there have been times when we have received ratable reductions. We have not passed those ratable reductions on. Oftentimes, that's because it has to do with access issues or other things that we're trying. So, for example, we have not passed on ratable reductions in the area of primary care because we think that is something we need to be doing as much as we can to ensure people are using primary care. I think what's a little bit different between that and what your proposal does is that is something that we made the decision based on how we wanted to prioritize and send services to do that, whereas this language would prohibit us, that it would take, so we're at risk for the contract, but it would tie our hands into what we could do from a network strategy. And so not only would we be opposed to that because it would limit our ability to incent or disincent certain types of services, if you will, it also, I believe, and Ms. Pete can speak to this better than I, become an actuarial soundness issue when it's a requirement on the health plans rather than the health plans volunteering to do it for one reason or the other.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Abel. Moving on. Before you move on, I probably would have voted no on this, understanding that. But I bet just to help the two chairs here, this might be one of those things in the letter you might be getting about concerns that will, and just to keep you a little list of things that might be coming your way soon. So.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have one other person.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I just have one other question for Ms. Pete, and that is, is your actuary still giving you automatically a 2% increase in the administrative costs for the health plans.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Senator Berglund, when we develop the rates, we look at the increases, changes in utilization. We look at changes in enrollment.
Not,
that will
not
impact
talking
costs,
about
right.
any of those things. I'm just talking about the little line that says 2% for administration. Every year, that's.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, the reason that you see that line is that other health care costs tend to trend higher than 2 or 3%. We have limited increases on administrative to the lower level. If health care costs were trending at 6% or 8%, we didn't want to trend administration at that same cost, and so that at that same trend, and so we marked it down.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Do you
give yourself a 2% increase in administering claims every year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, alas, we do not.
I think my point has been made then.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Abler.
The paper, I think it was 10.9%. Was that the new number on HMO? Administration is in the 10% range. And can you tell me, if you're getting 2%, how do you factor that other administration into your rates? You know what I'm talking about then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, actually, if you look at, and I've got Karen Pete here to keep me honest on this, but if you look at the administrative rates, I think the 10.9% it is probably the insurance rates for the commercial markets, which also includes the MCHA assessments, over 3% in taxes. The administrative rates for government programs actually vary by product because there's different administrative requirements, but they're typically, for most of the plans, it varies, but they're actually lower, so more like 6 or 7%. And I would like to remind the committee that this legislature last year did put a cap in for administrative rates. So even if there's more additional requirements passed on that we have to comply with, our administrative rates have been capped.
Thank you.
I would now ask Senator Bergen.
That, Mr. Chairman, is exactly why I just asked the question I asked, because they were capped last year. Whether the actuary who does the actuarial soundness for the department continues to increase them is another question.
Mr. Chair?
So,
Mr. Chair,
I would
may I respond to the Senator's
yes,
comment? I would
Ms.
just
B.
like to say that administrative costs are capped at a portion of the rate, and if costs go up or if additional people are served, the amount of money that's spent increases, and so the percent 6% is against the number. So if rates go down, then you would expect to see the 6%. The 6% might stay at 6%, but the amount of money that would be affected would go down if rates went down. 6% is, we attend to the 6% or 6.2%, whatever it is in statute.
Okay, I would like to ask if there's someone from the Management and Budget Office, and I think it's Catherine Brando, if she's here to comment on both the Senate proposal and the House proposal.
Mr. Chair, members, Catherine Brando with Minnesota Management and Budget. I have just received the amendment, the House proposal, so I haven't had a chance to fully review this. However, the Senate proposal is almost identical to a proposal that was vetted last year, and it is my understanding that MMB's concerns about that proposal were widely circulated, and because of the high risk of litigation associated with that proposal, MMB is not inclined to track the savings associated with that.
So what do you mean by not, Ms. Brando, not inclined to track the savings in that. So you just think you would insist there would be no savings?
In the planning, Mr. Chair, members, in the planning estimates that would be done for 12 and 13, at this time with what MMB has reviewed, MMB would not be inclined to include the savings associated with the proposal.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chair, we do have a fiscal note that backs up our spreadsheet. And one of the reasons we put it in the second biennium is so that we would have more certainty about a lawsuit prior to the biennium that we would be taking the savings in. Just because, Mr. Chairman, there's threat of a lawsuit doesn't mean that you know what the outcome of a lawsuit would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the consideration of the amount of time before the savings would be incurred was considered by MMB. However, the risks of litigation associated with the proposal are not different from last year. And so, therefore, at this time, MMB's decision about tracking the savings and the planning estimates would not change.
Any questions? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Brando, we can't recall an instance where you've actually booked a reduction in a forecast due to potential or pending litigation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I've been at MMB almost 6 months, so your recollection is certainly probably better than mine. However, it is my understanding that MMB looks at every proposal on a case-by-case basis, and they reviewed this one as well as the one last year. And oftentimes, proposals that have a high risk of litigation do not make it this far. So there are proposals that might have some contingencies associated with litigation, but the devil's in the details, as they say. There would be differences with those proposals as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
I think the difference is last year the request was to remove the proposal from the legislation because of the uncertainty about whether the savings would be there for a budget where we were taking savings for that biennium in the last year of the biennium. In this case, that's not what we're proposing.
Ms. Brando.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, members, I understand the distinction you are making, and that was raised with management and MMB, but at this point, the decision is the same as the proposal regarding the savings as the decision that was made last year.
Any further questions?
I just remember last year, I think that there was a promise to have litigation. I think the hallway was just expecting to do it. I mean, as I recall, if my memory is right, they were planning on it as well. And the other, maybe it'd be a jobs bill, Mr. Chair.
So any further questions? Senator Solon.
Mr. Chair, anything that we do could be open to litigation. So I'm not sure how the department picks and chooses what they're going to forecast or not forecast.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pretner Solon, you're exactly right, and that's why they don't book savings or lack of savings based on potential litigation.
Okay, any further? Okay, thank you for your testimony. What else do we have? Well, then why don't we go to the number six, and Representative Clark, that's the Hennepin County pilot on cancer surveillance, and it was in your bill, and it's not in the Senate bill, so if you want to talk about that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hand out a couple of letters that are useful to the committee. This is a feasibility study. And it's the letters I'm handing out are from Hennepin County Medical Center and from the State of Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. This study would be a way to finally get some information to our Department of Health on how they can eventually add several categories to their cancer surveillance system. It's an issue I've been working on for a lot of years. I wanted them to collect data on occupational, residential, and military history. And the reason for that is so that we can see how to do a system that we could eventually understand if there are relationships between these environmental exposures in those areas and cancer. And so I kind of gave up on trying to get the Department of Health to do it and went to a local unit of government who has a highly respected cancer registry system, the Hennepin County Cancer Registry. And I had a meeting with them, talked with the medical director of Hennepin County Medical Center, and there's their whole team there. I think there are about six or seven people there. And they said that not only could they do it, they'd be glad to do it, they would be glad to help the state figure out how we could put a system together to gather this information in the future. So what we have here, and I believe there's on one place in the bill, the word military is left out. It is in several other places, but I want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, that we eventually get it added back in. But basically, we're talking about a low-cost feasibility pilot project that will instruct us on how to do this work in the future. And what we did is, in the bill, say that the equivalent of one FTE position would be transferred from the Department of Health through a grant to the Hennepin County Medical Center's Cancer Center, and they will be the ones who will do this work. And the funding will come from the Chronic Disease and Environmental Epidemiology section. I originally had it coming directly from the Cancer Registry there, and they asked me to just give them a little broader flexibility, so I did. So, Mr. Chairman, that's basically what it does. We added language in the House that improves or strengthens the consent that must be provided. This will be done in a, you know, with the full IHB, the human health study work that they do. There are about 500 new cancer cases per year in Hennepin County Medical Center's Cancer Registry, and so it'll give us a reasonable way to begin to look at what do we need to do at the state, how would we collect the data, what would be the kind of staff that would be appropriate, and so on. So that's the health's position on that.
Any questions, Representative or Senator Lori?
That's fine. Thanks, Mr. Chair. This would be something that the Department of Health would work on Hennepin County Medical Center. Do they have? Could we hear from the Department of Health on what their thoughts are?
Sure. Yeah. As I mentioned, I've been trying to actually accomplish this for quite a few years, and the Department of Health they came back with something like a $3 million fiscal note for how they would do it for the whole state, and I said, okay, let's see if we can't begin with a smaller feasibility study. And I think this is reasonable. It's with a highly respected organization, and the medical director at Hennepin County is more than willing to do it. And you'll notice that in that letter is from Dr. Belzer, medical director, chief medical officer at Hennepin County, and then the letter from the Department of Veterans Affairs from our commissioner there, Clark Dyrud. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question?
Is there somebody from the Department of Health, though, that could just give their perspective on it?
Is there anybody? Assistant Commissioner Jacob.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Craig Akam. I'm with the Department of Health. This proposal takes the money for the study from the department's administrative budget and makes it into a grant to the Hennepin County Medical Center. And the department can't support any additional cuts to our administrative budget above what was recommended by the governor in his budget. The target for this committee is already above that amount. This would be an additional burden on the department above that.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay.
position is next. Sir, yeah, okay. And I'm going to give you the value of the one position.
And is this in the Senate or the House?
Representative Huntley, I wonder, Representative Clark, do you know, is there a value attributed to this position in terms of dollars?
Thank you for that question. We limited it up to $100,000, so it may not take that much. But in talking with the people at the Cancer Center at Hennepin County, they thought that would be, you know, more than adequate. $100,000 would be more than adequate. They're going to come back with what they will propose to the Department of Health, and I presume it'll be somewhere below that.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can just clarify, because this has never showed up on the House spreadsheet, it would actually be a grant. It would have to appropriate money to Hennepin County. Is that, am I getting this all kind of right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's correct. It doesn't show up in the spreadsheet because there is no new appropriation for these funds. This would be a reallocation from our existing general fund base in the form of a grant to Hennepin County for this pilot.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Acom, I still don't understand. I could understand if you were loaning them a staff person, but if we're actually transferring funds to Hennepin County, there has to be an appropriation that's approved by the legislature. It has to show up as a line item on a spreadsheet, I believe.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if you look, we do list it as in our documents, and perhaps if it's not correct on the spreadsheet, I don't know. I guess I checked with Mr. Wallace, but it is in our riders and on 323.23. And actually, while we're there, I need to add on line 23.25 the word military that got left off of that line for some reason. It's just a technical amendment, Mr. Chair, but let's move that as we go forward.
So, Representative Clark, are you making a motion to the House language?
I am, Mr. Chair. On line 323.25, after the word residential, please insert comma and military.
Does staff have that down?
No, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat that one more time?
Okay. On line 323.25, R36, it says to collect occupational, residential, and it should say and military history. The same as it says on the line below 323.31. It got left off on the higher line. I don't know why.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, are you on the rider language or the...
I am. Or I'm actually looking, I'm on
Article 11
R36, or Article 15. On the R36. The rider language is, it's there, missing there too. That's where it was, yeah. And then it's in the comparison as well. That's the rider language on R36.
Does the rider have to be changed too?
I think so.
It's not rider.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it's just me, but it seems to me that if we were going to do this, the way to show it would be to show the $100,000 reduction in the department's allocation by the legislature and then show $100,000 being appropriated to somebody else.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we wouldn't have any objection to showing that on the spreadsheet because that, in essence, that is how it works. It's a reduction to our base appropriation, and the rider directs us to appropriate the grant to Hennepin County Medical Center.
So, Mr. Chairman, let me ask a different question about this then, now that we've clarified what we're doing. Would you object to this if it was not a reduction to your appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think that the department has expressed concerns in conversations with Representative Clark about this methodology for doing cancer surveillance. And a group was convened over the summer to provide recommendations on collecting residential, occupational, and military histories. And they believe that there is a correct way to do that, which unfortunately has a high fiscal cost to it. And I think that has been the source of disagreement between us.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Acomb, I understand what the department thinks about requiring them to do this. My question to you is, if this money were not coming out of your base appropriation, would you object to the appropriation going to Hennepin County?
Mr. Acomb.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think we would have less objections.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion of that? And we, do they have a, you have this in a second. But they're in a different bill. We've passed out an amendment, the A99 amendment, and this is identical to Senate language that was passed off the Senate floor, I believe. And so we would like to, I think this is just clarification of this particular program, and we would like to put it in this bill, because we're not sure the status of the other one. So I would move the A99 amendment to the House language. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So that's in the House language. So these were passed out.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. This is that injection thing.
What? This was in the department. It's going to be language. It has to do with medications that are given to
people at home. Yeah. The lobbyist talking.
So, Mr. Chairman, we had distributed yesterday an A9 amendment, most of which dealt with kind of making sense between the House and Senate language on PCA, and there were a few other technical issues in there. And people wanted to look at it longer. I believe these do not relate to money issues in the PCA program, but just other technical language differences. And my understanding is that now the House has looked at it and they're ready to go ahead and adopt it. So I would move the A9 amendment.
So Senator Berglund moves the A9 amendment. This would be to the agreed upon bill.
This is on R28 of Article 9, Senate language. I think once we do the amendment, we don't need to worry about it because it's just reconciling different parts of the PCA language that are in different parts of the bill on the part of the Senate and the House.
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the amendment amends the House language, and I think that would then make us pretty much consistent or the same with the Senate on all these items, and we could just adopt the same and similars.
Mr. Giel is shaking his head that that's not right, but
Mr. Giel.
If we just adopt it, we will be okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think for the most part the amendment is amending the Senate language to adopt the agreement that was worked out between the Department of Human Services and the advocates.
That's Senate language, Senate.
And it would be amending some provisions that have already been adopted. It would be amending a lot of provisions that have not yet been adopted.
So this amends some things we've already adopted. But some other things we haven't. So, is there any further discussion on that amendment?
Which amendment are we on?
A9 was handed out yesterday.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted. So we're going to go to the Senate proposal. David, disappear. Oh, there he is.
The confused.
Well, that one's adopted. We're going to.
Yeah, because it has.
A15.
Okay. Where is it?
These are over there.
We can handle it later. Okay. Representative Hosch has a A98 amendment, which is to the PCA language. And I think it. Call Representative Hosch.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the amendment in front of me, but I know what it does. Mr. Chair, members, the amendment essentially addresses the form used for doing a service plan or care plan for PCA services. Right now we have that it has to be the fee-for-service plan. Fee-for-service medical assistance form. Some of the plans had concerns with that may require them to change systems. So this is a compromise language that I do believe all stakeholders are in agreement with. It addresses some of the concerns and I think will allow the health plans to prepare for the Compass implementation too. That hopefully will happen sooner rather than later.
And Representative Hosch, is this to something that's already been adopted, or is it something that's not been adopted yet?
Mr. Chair, I believe we had similar language in this section, so this would be amending what it's already adopted between both the House and the Senate.
Okay.
Didn't Mr. Chair?
Representative Laurie. Senator Laurie. That's twice already. Tonight.
Have been. That's three times, actually, but it's okay. Who's counting? I don't think we've adopted any of the PCA stuff really yet. Have we?
Yeah, the identicals we have.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Laurie, has this been discussed with the folks that have been working on this?
Well, I'm a bit at a loss because Senator Prettner-Solon has taken the lead on this. Is one of the program integrity pieces, and Prettner-Solon has been kind of our lead on that. And
hey, why don't we just hold on this for a while?
So, but I do believe that she's okay with this. But
I just like to wait till she's here to vote on it. If you don't mind,
that's fine, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Haas, you want to discuss the A15 amendment? If it relates to PCA?
Yes.
Maybe we should just hold that one, too.
Would you just want me to give an overview of it quickly?
Yeah, sure. Okay. You give an overview, but we'll wait till Senator Solon gets here.
Actually, Mr. Chair, this is from Senator Solon. She gave this to me yesterday. Everybody agrees to this. The nurses had a concern with some of the assessment for people with complex health needs. This requires that if somebody does have a complex health need, that a public health nurse or registered nurse from an interdisciplinary team has to be consulted. It's agreed upon by everybody, and actually I think Senator Solon will be making the motion on this. And that's it for the PCA.
You want to do that now?
Let's just wait till she's here.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
In the flurry of paper that's gone around to people, there's two amendments I'll describe, and then the Senate can review them and decide if they like them. Okay. There's an amendment called the A96. We adopted the overnight supervision language. There was some concern by some people about the storage of the information from the people who are getting monitored at night. They're opting in. They're informed as best they can be formed, the families know. And Mr. Kerber and Mr. Nelson worked this out along with Mr. Neumeister and some others. And it puts it into a place where it's agreeable to all those different people. That's the A96 amendment. And Mr. Nelson can testify to it if he wants. And then the A89 amendment is a technical thing on behalf of Express Scripts on the medication therapy management section. These have both been adopted already. This allows a little more flexibility to the PBMs to use a pharmacist or someone under the supervision of a pharmacist. So at some point we can take those up when the Senate's comfortable.
For the Senate members, the A96 amendment relates to the fact that we think there's cost savings available for electronic monitoring of people with basically disabilities, so you don't have to have a on-site person observing them. But then you get into the privacy issues. So I think this takes care of the privacy problem.
Right.
And we'll let you look at that and come back later.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we have any objection at this point in time with the A98 amendment.
Is that 89?
89.
Yeah.
So I would move adoption of that amendment.
So Senator Berglund moves adoption of the 89 amendment. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Solon, we've been waiting anxiously for your return. And Representative Hosh, why don't you go through the, I think you have, what, two or three amendments that relate to PCA? Yeah, just explain what they are for Senator Solon.
Well, the two amendments that we have, one is, and Senator Solon, you gave this to me yesterday, so it's the one with the requiring that nurses or a public health nurse, part of a multidisciplinary team, be involved with assessments of people with complex medical health care needs. And the Nurses Association agrees with this. I believe the advocates agree with it, and there's no concerns.
Senator Solon, did you want to move that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I would move the It's the SCH 1362A15 amendment.
Okay. Any discussion of the amendment? Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm sorry, but I haven't seen this amendment, and there weren't enough copies. And I did have a conversation with Mary Jo George from the Minnesota Nurses Association. On this issue, I didn't know that she was bringing this amendment forward, but if it is what I think it is, it's an amendment that would require health plans to require them to use public health nurses in their assessment process. They do use public health nurses, but they also use other types of nurses, RNs, for example. And so to require that you can only use a public health nurse, which, I, as I understand it, is a higher level than an RN, could present some access problems. Thank you. Okay. Okay. It looks like maybe it's just fine. I'm sorry to take up the committee's time, but we had not been consulted, so thank you for that opportunity.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. That's an oversight that I'll take responsibility for. But I think it pretty much goes back to how it's currently done at this moment.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask, does this have any fiscal impact?
No.
Okay. Senator Sullivan?
The Department of the DHS did sign off on this, so they indicated there'd be no fiscal note.
Okay, so any further discussion of the A-15 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And Representative Hosh, the A-98 amendment.
Mr. Chair, the A-98 amendment deals with the fee-for-service forms and just saying that on the fee-for-service form or something consistent with the medical assistance fee-for-service form or that the Department of Human Services contracts what their requirements are. And I believe everybody has, I think, come to an agreement on this. It's not as strong as some would like. It's not as weak as some would like, so it's probably a good amendment.
Senator Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, is it in front of us? Apparently it's a little bit different than the one I have, so. I'm not sure where you got the amendment.
Maybe we could just hold on this and have a little more discussion.
I'm fine with that.
Okay, so we'll hold on for a bit. And let me ask staff, have we adopted the A-9 amendment?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Kerber, is the only testimony on the amendment I passed out on that overnight supervision thing? Mr. Kerber is in the audience if you want to. If you want or not, it's up to you.
I think we could just talk to him on our own time.
That's fine.
I mean, you know.
Just trying to be helpful. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator Solon.
I can accept Representative Hosh's amendment. I understand what it is now. I think, just to be clear, it is an agreement also with the health plans that that they agreed to this also.
So, Representative Hosh moves the A-98 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the A-98 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate has an offer we'd like to make to the House.
Yes,
and
Mr.
We'd
Chair.
Be prepared to.
It's there.
We'd be prepared to present it now.
The
Mr. Chair?
Senator,
while we're waiting, there is one more amendment to be made to the PCA.
Oh, okay.
There's more than one. There's a whole sheet here of PCA stuff we have left to do, folks.
Okay.
Is there more PCA?
Mr. Chairman, I think
Senator
we could,
Berglund.
I think we have them passed out to the conference committee table. We could ask Mr. Godfrey to walk through the proposal.
Mr. Chair, members, just start out with a couple of things. One is we do have copies for the audience. We just need to go to duplicating to get them. And so if everybody could bear with us in the audience about that, it would be appreciated. And the other thing is I'd just like to apologize. The copying machine in our office is not really working correctly. So the staple on this document is at the lower left-hand corner, which might throw you off a bit as we go through this, but just pay attention to the line numbers and we'll make it through. With that, the first change is on page 2, line 110. This is just a technical fix in the Senate position to align our federal stabilization funding level at $110 million with the House. We needed to reduce the amount of stabilization funds being spent on children economic assistance management by a little less than $3 million there. The next change is on line 282. And that would be page 6. The Senate is now accepting the House position on an MFIB child increase for school readiness service agreements, and this is coming from the TANF fund. On line 290 is the next change right below that. That one is the Senate is accepting the House position on school readiness funds for the basic sliding fee program. It's paid for with the general fund. Then turning to line 319, there's a change in the Senate line on TANF refinancing for MFIB general fund spending in the bill. It's been reduced. It's now at $23.8 million savings to the general fund. On line 328 is a new TANF item. It's federal stimulus funds for MFIB caseload growth. It saves $1.3 million in fiscal year 11. On line 360 is an increased appropriation of $1 million to line 363, the supported services grants item that the Senate has. Then turning to the next page, page 8 on line 369, the Senate position on a moratorium for the 60-month limit has been shortened from 24 months to 14 months. And this saves the general fund around $6 million in 10 and 11 to the Senate position. Then the next one is on line 579. Which is on page 12. The Senate is now removing from its position the transitional consultation for persons entering housing with services. Then on line 617, which would be the next, well, let's see, it would be, yes, the top of page 13, the Senate is not eliminating rebasing for nursing facilities in fiscal year 10. So it allows for some additional rebasing to take place and then eliminates it in fiscal year 14. That changed the Senate position to $3.4 million in lost savings. Then the next line is 735. on page 15. The Senate is now accepting House and Governor's position to provide general fund funding for the CD entitlement grants, county share, non-reservation Native American continuing care services, and that spends $284,000 in 10-11 and $406,000 in 12-13. Then the next item is line 745. Senate is now accepting the House position to on line 747, to delay assertive community treatment or ACT teams implementation for 1.5 years. This creates $2.4 million in additional savings for the Senate and $2.3 million in the tails. Then the next item is line 1085. On line 1085, page 22, the Senate is reduced in half its modification of anesthesia coverage and rates item. The idea here would be to, instead of eliminating the payment for anesthetist supervision of CRNAs, we would instead have a rate reduction, which is yet to be determined, but this would be the amount of savings that this item would derive. So we'll need to work with the department on what that rate reduction would be. But it does now save $1.2 million less than the original Senate position. Then the next item is on line 1116. The Senate now is removing from its position the carve-out of dental services from PMAP. Associated with that is on line 1127, the Senate is now removing a dental rate increase for fee-for-service. And then that also changes the interaction with the next line, or the next item on line 1136, limits on dental services. We now have higher numbers because we're no longer doing the carve-out. And this saves, this goes back to the Senate's original position on this, saves $13 million in 10-11 in the general fund, 24.4 in 12-13. Then on line 1199, this page 24, the Senate is now reducing significantly the amount of rebasing that will be delayed in fiscal year 12 to hospitals. Removed almost all of the savings from this item, but there's still a remainder of $508,000 in fiscal year 12. And then the next line is 1207, which is on page 25. The Senate now has reverted back to its original position on the House health care provider payment delay for fiscal year 11, and in fiscal year 12 has almost returned to its original position for 12 and 13. Then on line 1216, there's been some adjustment to the inpatient payment delay to make up for some other technical corrections. Now being delayed in the inpatient delay is $13.7 million in 11 and $6.6 million in 13. Then the next item is on line 1374. On line 1374, page 28, the Senate is now accepting the House position on Mindo limits. Saves $4.6 million, 10, 11, 23.7, and 12, 13. And then the final item is on line 1405. I didn't find it. 1405 is a new Senate item we alluded to earlier today in discussing the fee-for-service dental rate increase. This is an enhanced MA rate for state-operated services dental. The amount of the rate enhancement is $750,000 a year, and it begins 6 months into fiscal year 10. We also have on line 1408 a appropriation for state-operated services community clinic of one time of $777,000 to assist them with a deficit they may have in the program and also to get some money to them prior to the MA rate being approved by the federal government. And, Mr. Chair, members, that's the completion of the walkthrough.
Thank you very much, and it's going to take us a while to go through this, but you certainly have made some, I think, pretty big moves, and I'm optimistic that we will get done here sometime. And with that,
Mr. Chairman, I think it depends on how much more testimony you've arranged for us to listen to.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, apparently the leadership has announced that we might not finish tomorrow night.
I have not been given that instruction.
So I haven't either.
So I expect that we are still supposed to be done tomorrow night at midnight.
Well, it's certainly my intent to have this done tomorrow at midnight. And with that, of course, I just argued against myself, but why don't we recess until 8:15?
Tonight.
Tonight. Oh, we're in recess.
Along with this goes an expectation that you will fix your dental.
Seriously, I've lost track of my
what? I gotta go downstairs.
Sorry, I'm not trying to do that too.
Who needs to eat?
They were passed.
Got one.
And Tom, we'd like to.
Want to eat?
Is that the
Okay. Okay.
A letter from Prime West.
Yeah.
Voted on that one yet?
The no, that was. And then we just put it aside.
8:15. We've got to 8:15. Back here.
What do you want to do?
Yep.
We're still waiting to adapt the sections.
They didn't have anything, right? I thought this was going to be with, is it with TANF funds? Is that what he said? I thought he said something about TANF.
Well, TANF here.